The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Katie Neuhauser for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Religion News Service. Our first article for today is entitled, The Christian DNA of Suspected White House Correspondent's Dinner Gunman. This is the byline. President Donald Trump described the would-be assassin as anti-Christian. The evidence hints at a complex faith background. In a manifesto reportedly sent to family members moments before he attempted to storm past security at the White House Correspondents Association dinner Saturday evening, April 25th, Cole Thomas Allen wrote, "Thank you to my family, both personal and church, for your love over these last 31 years." Though Allen, who was charged Monday with attempting to assassinate the president, didn't specify which church he was thanking, context about his parents' church, publicly available information about his involvement in a Christian student ministry, and his religious language in his manifesto provide a glimpse into the religious background of the would-be assassin. Despite Allen's mention of his church, he has been described by President Donald Trump as anti-Christian. When you read his manifesto, he hates Christians. That's one thing for sure, Trump said in a phone interview with Fox News. The 31-year-old from Torrance, California, was an amateur video game developer and part-time teacher with a Master of Science degree from California State University, per his LinkedIn profile. From 2013 to 2017, his profile indicates Allen was a mechanical engineering student at Caltech in Pasadena, where he was involved with Caltech Christian Fellowship, which describes itself as non-denominational. The group emphasizes confessing Jesus as personal Lord and Savior, and salvation by grace through faith, and links to both evangelical and mainline Protestant churches on their website. He was definitely a strong believer in evangelical Christianity at the time that I knew him, Elizabeth Turlinden, who was also a member of Caltech Christian Fellowship, told the New York Times. The suspect's father, Thomas Allen, until recently was listed online as an elder at Grace United Reformed Church in Torrance, a church in the same neighborhood as the home Allen shared with his parents. The church is affiliated with the United Reformed Churches in North America, a small theologically conservative group of Reformed Protestant churches that, in 1996, split from the Christian Reformed Church over concerns about pure doctrine, according to their website. It had to do with women's ordination to church offices, explained James Bratt, a historian and professor emeritus at Calvin University. A historic Dutch Reformed denomination, the Christian Reformed Church began to allow local churches the option of ordaining women in the early 1990s. The people who went into the United Reformed Churches just thought, this is a terrible break with biblical authority, said Bratt. A federation rather than a denomination, the United Reformed Churches in North America is made up of independent churches that emphasize the authority of local elders. The United Reformed Churches in North America does not have a spokesman able to speak regarding the members or officers of any of our congregations, the URCNA stated clerk told RNS. At Grace United Reformed Church, formal church leadership is held by men, and visitors are required to obtain elder approval before participating in communion. While these elements could hint at a theologically conservative faith background, Allen was described as politically progressive in recent years. According to the White House, Allen had propensity for making radical statements, especially after becoming involved in left-wing activism in Los Angeles. On Saturday, he came to the correspondents' dinner armed with a 12-gauge shotgun and a .38 caliber semi-automatic pistol. His alleged manifesto, published by the New York Post Sunday morning, indicates that Allen's targets included administration officials and potentially Secret Service, security, and police. I would still go through most everyone here to get to the targets if it were absolutely necessary, the manifesto says. Allen framed his actions as a response to the actions taken by Trump administration, although he did not name the president directly. What my representatives do reflects on me, Allen wrote, and I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. He wrote that he does not expect forgiveness, but also justified his actions, arguing he is not required to follow the Christian principle of turning the other cheek, an instruction given by Jesus during the Sermon on the Mount that many interpret as a call for forgiveness over vengeance. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also, Jesus says in Matthew 5:39. Allen argued that this direction only applies when someone wrongs you personally, arguing that turning the other cheek when others are oppressed is complicity. Turning the other cheek for when you yourself are oppressed. I'm not the person raped in a detention camp. I'm not the fisherman executed without trial. I'm not a school kid blown up or a child starved or a teenage girl abused by the many criminals in this administration, Allen wrote. He also quoted Jesus a second time, addressing the objection that Christians ought to yield unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Allen argued that Jesus' instruction in Matthew 22:21, which is sometimes interpreted as a call to submit to government authority, is not relevant in this case. Insofar as representatives and judges do not follow the law, no one is required to yield them anything so unlawfully ordered, he wrote. Christian leaders from across the theological spectrum have spoken out to condemn Allen's actions. On X, Evangelical pastor Greg Laurie echoed President Trump's description of Allen as anti-Christian, claiming Allen carried significant anti-Trump and anti-Christian rhetoric on his social media accounts. The New York Post reported that Allen, under the moniker Cold Force on the social media platform Blue Sky, condemned what he perceived as the Christian hypocrisy of the Trump administration. Allen's Blue Sky account now appears to be deactivated. Shane Claiborne, a longtime Christian activist and a vocal critic of Trump's policies, posted on X that he was glad the president wasn't killed, and he called for protecting people over gun rights. As always, we must insist that violence is the problem, not the solution. It is wrong to kill, whether it's done by Trump or by a vigilante, wrote Claiborne. Two wrongs don't make a right. And with that, we end our first article of today. Next up, we have another article. It's a little bit longer, and it's entitled, Two New Books Reveal Secrets, Alliances Behind Pope Leo's Election. And the byline states, two new books reveal insight about the conclave that elected Pope Leo XIV, tracing the alliances, rivalries, and quiet maneuvering that shaped the first American papacy. Nearly a year after the conclave that elected Pope Leo XIV, two deeply sourced books offer competing portraits of the context and maneuvering behind the first U.S. pope's election. Popes, Dollars, and Wars by renowned Italian journalist Massimo Franco traces how the Church in the United States, long treated in Rome as a periphery of the Catholic Church, became a force to be reckoned with in the centuries-old institution. Published on March 31st, it is currently only available in Italian. Franco's book relies on research and never-before-seen documents scavenged from the bunker of the Vatican's own secret archives, now called the Pontifical Apostolic Archive, with the guidance of its former prefect, Bishop Sergio Pagano. The documents show how decades of U.S. money, millionaire donors, and fundraising cardinals made a pope from the U.S. increasingly plausible. The second book, The Election of Pope Leo XIV, The Last Surprise of Pope Francis, by veteran Vatican reporters and power couple Elisabetta Piquet of Argentina's La Nación newspaper and Gerald O'Connell of the U.S.-based America magazine, delves into their accounts of the conclave. Published last month, it's a deep dive into the events preceding the Pope's election, with exclusive interviews and insights with thought leaders and kingmakers in the conclave. Both books rely heavily on unnamed sources, unsurprising in a Vatican culture where discretion and curial favor often outweigh transparency. After Pope Francis's death on April 21st, 2025, cardinals from around the world gathered in Rome for the general congregations, the closed-door meetings that set the stage for the conclave. As Piquet and O'Connell wrote, conservative cardinals who opposed aspects of Francis's papacy made forceful speeches calling for doctrinal clarity and a return to tradition. At the same time, cardinals from across the globe were looking for a pastor close to ordinary Catholics in troubled times. But the most decisive conversations happened outside the Vatican over private dinners in cardinals' residences. Franco takes readers inside the Pontifical North American College, or NAC, the seminary on Rome's Janiculum Hill, where future U.S. church leaders are trained and where 8 of the 10 American cardinal electors stayed during the conclave. In the NAC's Red Room, named for its scarlet velvet chairs and portraits of influential cardinals on the walls, the cardinals met to discuss the future of the papacy. During conversations around the rectangular table of the Red Room dining hall, Franco wrote, "The differences among the leaders of the episcopacy were smoothed over." Then, New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan, close to Republican circles and a leading figure in the Papal Foundation, an American charity supporting papal initiatives around the world, played a central role, according to Franco. Founded by John Paul II, the foundation has raised an estimated $250 million and was especially relevant as cardinals discussed Vatican financial scandals and deficits ahead of the conclave. It is said that the traditionalists, including Dolan, were aiming for a solid conservative like the Archbishop of Budapest, Péter Erdőe, who is considered close to former Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, Franco wrote. Support for Erdőe was strong among conservatives, especially in the United States. Brian Birch, the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See, spoke favorably of him, as did Cardinal Gerhard Müller, a frequent Mar-a-Lago visitor and vocal Francis critic often featured on EWTN. U.S. journalists Edward Penton and Diane Montagna were accused of trying to sway cardinals by giving them a book titled The College of Cardinals Report, describing where cardinals stood on hot-button issues such as female ordination and the welcoming of LGBTQ Catholics. President Donald Trump publicly backed Dolan for Pope and later posted an AI-generated picture of himself dressed as Pope. An unnamed source in contact with the cardinals told Piquet that Trump dressed as Pope wasn't a joke, but a message. I'm watching you and I want a domesticated Catholic Church. But the U.S.-led conservative push had the opposite effect, quietly consolidating support for a dark horse candidate, Cardinal Robert Prevost, the Chicago-born head of the Vatican's Dicastery for Bishops. During secret dinners co-hosted by British Ambassador to the Holy See, Chris Trott, and Cardinal Vincent Nichols, Archbishop of Westminster, brought together 14 cardinals of the British Commonwealth. Some of them had worked with Prevost and liked his style and were ready to put their weight behind him, Piquet and O'Connell wrote. We learned that some of Prevost's earlier supporters for the papacy came from a group of 23 cardinal electors who are part of the 30-plus member dicastery for bishops, a group the authors added that regularly met at the Vatican. Among them was Cardinal Blaise Kubik, of Chicago, who had known Prevost for many years. At the residence of German Cardinal Reinhold Marx, referred to as Casa Marx, cardinals met to discuss the qualities of the next pope and Prevost's candidacy, P.K. and O'Connell wrote. There are also some non-bishops, men and women, working in the Roman Curia, who are actively seeking to convince the Latin American electors that Prevost is the best choice, the authors added, citing Emil Scuda, the first female secretary of the Pontifical Commission for Latin America, and Cardinal Carlos Gustavo Castillo Matagaslio, Archbishop of Lima, Peru. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron organized two meals around the time of Francis's funeral with Andrea Riccardi, the founder of the powerful Catholic movement, the Community of St. Egidio, which allegedly supported progressive French Cardinal Jean-Marc Avelin as the next pope, the authors wrote. Both books show that Italians hoping to reclaim the papacy failed to unite behind one candidate. Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin entered the conclave as the favorite, but his lack of pastoral experience made progressives wary. Uncertain, while conservatives mistrusted him for his role in drafting a controversial deal with China that gave Beijing power in the selection of bishops. In the days leading up to the conclave, P.K. and O'Connell published reports suggesting that the Secretary of State was at odds with Francis, which some said was the nail in the coffin for Parolin's chances of becoming pope. In their book, P.K. and O'Connell bring readers inside the conclave, detailing mundane and extraordinary events within the secretive election, including the discovery of an active cell phone, which cardinals are banned from having during the conclave. It was in the pocket of an older cardinal. On the very first vote, only three cardinals received between 20 and 30 votes, Erdo, Prevost, and Parolin. The strong support for Erdo shows the conservatives were well organized, O'Connell wrote. The second vote showed a significant shift, with Erdo losing several votes. Prevost is the main beneficiary, O'Connell wrote. Dolan later recounted that on the morning of the second day of voting, he shared some peanut butter and jelly with Prevost and got to know the Chicago-born cardinal better. Five of the more conservative U.S. cardinals were skeptical of Prevost, whom they viewed as a more moderate version of Francis. But those differences were smoothed out during the conclave, according to an unnamed cardinal cited in Franco's book. By the third vote, Parolin and Avelin were still in the running, but the papacy was only a few votes away for Prevost. It was very clear that we were moving in a direction that was probably unstoppable, Kubrick would later tell O'Connell in an interview. Pope Leo was elected on the fourth vote, having appeased conservatives, but without winning over some members of the Curia. O'Connell reports a telling moment after Leo was announced as Pope. Curial officials expected to celebrate Parolin's election were stunned, frozen, defeated, he wrote. But a Monsignor tries to react positively. Lo fermo uno di noi, which means we will make him one of us, he remarks, trying to raise their spirits. Franco's book also includes a previously unreported meeting in June between the Chinese delegation and the Vatican, roughly 1 month after Leo's election. He wrote that the delegation left Rome unconvinced and decided to not make a rash judgment, suggesting that relations with Beijing will likely continue to be a persistent challenge for the new papacy. P.K. and O'Connell claimed that it was ultimately Francis's shaping of the College of Cardinals that led to Leo's election. Francis could not choose his successor, but he created the conditions that made Leo's election possible, the authors wrote. It was his last surprise. For Franco, Leo's election allows the Vatican to play on an ever-evolving international chessboard as a credible advocate for peace. It will be promoted by a church that will have to reconcile with itself before reconciling with the rest of the world, he wrote. From his perspective, the first geopolitical challenge of the U.S. papacy will be the ghost of its own divisions. And this ends the second article, which was a bit lengthy, but kind of interesting. Next up, for something a little different, we have an article entitled Study, Gen Z Women Are Losing Their Religion. Byline states women have long been more religious than men, but a new study finds the gap closing as more young women under 30 identify as none, unaffiliated. Women have long been the backbone of religion in America. They are more likely than men to identify as religious, and they say faith is important in their lives. They attend services, and they pray. That's especially true among older women, according to data from the Pew Research Center. But times are changing, and more young women seem to be giving up on God, or at least organized religion. A new report released Wednesday from April 15th from Washington, D.C.-based Public Religion Research Institute found that 43% of adult women under 30 identify as none, those who claim no religious identity. That's up from 29% in 2013. PRRI found that unaffiliated young women outnumber unaffiliated men, 35%. Overall, PRRI found that 39% of Americans under 30 identify as none. The findings conflict with claims of a religious boom among young Americans. Looking at young adults, there is a shift happening, but it's not among Gen Z men, as some suggest. Instead, young women's declining religiosity has brought them on par with their male counterparts, said Melissa Deckman, CEO of PRRI. Other studies have found that the religion gender gap has shrunk among young people. Pew found that only 57% of young women and 58% of young men claim a religious identity, a virtual tie. Deckman said the data reflects political and social realities. Young women, she said, aren't interested in the kind of traditional gender roles that conservative religious groups are promoting. I think you're running into this head-on collision where a lot of younger women are just shedding religious labels because they don't endorse the views of a lot of conservative and outspoken churches, said Deckman. Carissa McCoskey, an assistant professor at Hartford Institute for Religion Research, said that overall, women still make up about 60% of active congregation members. McCoskey is part of a team that studies trends in congregational life rather than the general population. While young women, both millennials and Generation Z, attend services slightly less than men, they are still more likely than men to be part of a congregation. In all of our data, women are still much more likely to be participating in congregations, she said. Young people only make up about 14% of church members despite being about a quarter of the U.S. population. But she noted that the percentage of young people who say they are attending more regularly outnumbers the percentage who say they are attending less often. And there's no sign that religion in America will disappear anytime soon. PRRI's report, along with reports from Pew and other researchers, found that the rise of the unaffiliated, which has dominated religion headlines in recent decades, has plateaued. The percentage of Americans who claim no religion rose from 16% in 2007 to 31% in 2022, according to Pew, before settling at about 28%. Although the share of the population that is unaffiliated will likely rise as older religious Americans die and are replaced by younger, less devout Americans, most surveys show, that more than half of young Americans are religious. Deckman says religious groups will persist, but they're going to be smaller. I think the great irony is that we have a nation of people that are lonely. They're looking for connection, said Deckman. And in some ways, you would think that religious bodies would be the ideal place to have that. PRRI's report also showed stark differences in the religious makeup of the country's two major political parties. Republicans remain overwhelmingly Christian. 84% of Republicans identified as Christians, including 68% who were white Christians. Only 13% were identifying themselves as none. That's similar to 2013, when 86% of Republicans were Christian, including 75% who were white Christians. By contrast, the unaffiliated 34% now outnumber white Christians, which is 24%, among Democrats. Just over half, 58%, of Democrats identify as Christians, while 8% identify with other faiths. The report also showed that half of LGBTQ Americans identify as none, twice the percentage as straight Americans, which is 25%. Along with claims about young men flocking back to church, there's been a rise of Christian pastors and leaders known as Theo Bros, who are vocal online and promote very traditional general roles. Some even advocate repealing the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. That appeals to some social media influencers who embrace the title of trad wife and some young men, but it's unlikely to draw many people to church. As a growth strategy, you know, it seems to be a little dicey, said Deckman. And this is the end of this article. And we're getting close to time, but I will get as much through with this article as I can, keeping my eye on the ticking clock. This one is called Pastor Exits Nashville Church Keller Center Over Inappropriate Relationship with Man. The byline says, Sam Alberry is a pastor and apologist who teaches that God designs sex and marriage to occur exclusively between a man and a woman. Sam Alberry, a pastor and apologist who advocates for celibacy as the faithful path for LGBTQ plus Christians, has been disqualified from gospel ministry following an inappropriate relationship with an adult man in 2022, according to a statement from elders at Emmanuel Nashville, a non-denominational church where he has served as an associate pastor since 2023. The Nashville, Tennessee Church's statement, first reported by Protestia, said church elders were first made aware of the relationship between Alberry and another man in spring 2024, and based on information available at the time and the posture of Sam and the other party. The church determined it wasn't disqualifying behavior, but after receiving new information this January, per the statement, the elders reopened an investigation into Alberry's actions. While their relationship did not go as far as it could have, Sam's conduct constituted a serious breach of trust and a failure to walk in a manner worthy of the gospel, the statement said. The elders are unanimous in their decision that Sam is currently disqualified from gospel ministry. Sam agrees with this decision and has resigned from Emmanuel Church. Neither the church nor Alberry responded to requests for comment in time for publication, said Religious News Service. And I can't quite finish the rest of this article. There's not a whole lot left, but we've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Katie Neuhauser, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number, 919-832-5138. Thank you again so much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We'll see you next time.